I'm Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 168 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. This week's guest has had such an epic career as a musician and singer-songwriter that we're going to need two episodes to fit it all in. Dave Alvin. In part one, we start with where he is now, playing guitar in the ever-improvising psychedelic band The Third Mind. A few weeks ago, we had that band's stupendous drummer, Michael Jerome, as a guest. Previously, we have featured our friend Victor Krumenacher, The Third Mind's wonderful bassist, on Caro Pop. Assembling the right players was of primary importance to Alvin. They also recruited singer-songwriter Jesse Sykes and guitarist David Immergluck, who has played in Counting Crows and also with Krumenacher in Camper Van Beethoven and The Monks of Doom. For live shows and the new Live Mind album, Immergluck is replaced by another accomplished guitarist, Mark Caron, who has played in several Grateful Dead spin-off bands, including Rat Dog and The Other Ones. Alvin, as we know, got his musical start far from the world of the Grateful Dead. He first learned to play saxophone and flute while growing up in a household where he heard lots of blues by artists like Laverne Baker and Big Joe Turner. After Dave taught himself guitar, he and his older brother, singer Phil Alvin, started the Blasters in 1979.
Well, you a soldier boy on team in West Berlin. No music till it rocks, just a thousand violins. They want to hear some American.
That revved-up roots rock band became a fixture of the early 80s Los Angeles punk scene. Dave Alvin was the Blasters' main songwriter and lead guitarist, and he was with the band for four albums between 1980 and 1985. American Music, The Blasters, Nonfiction, and Hard Line. He also played with members of the powerhouse LA band X in their country folk spin-off, The Knitters. Then Alvin joined X itself, if only briefly, and contributed the signature song, 4th of July. Productive, accomplished solo career followed. Much of this discussion highlights Alvin's values as a musician. As he tells it, the Blasters had lots of rules. The Third Mind has few rules. Why does the latter appeal to him now? How does Bitches Brew era Miles Davis factor into all of this? Does Alvin get jazz envy? Is he a Grateful Dead fan? The Third Mind released its self-titled debut album in 2020. The plans to take the music on the road were thwarted by the 1-2 punch of COVID and Alvin's cancer diagnosis. When Alvin emerged on the other side of his treatments, his top priority was not to record another solo album or to team up again with singer-songwriter Jimmy Dale Gilmore, but to restart The Third Mind. The album The Third Mind 2 came out last year on Yep Rock, and the same label is releasing the live album Live Mind on February 14th. How is what Alvin is doing the opposite of what he calls choreographed modern music? At a time when he says most pop music is a Broadway show, why is it important to be a little out of control? Dave Alvin has learned a lot over the years and has tons to share musically and otherwise. Please enjoy part one of our Caro Pop conversation with Dave Alvin.
Grooving is easy, baby, if you know how.
I was just listening to Live Mind, and the Third Mind live album. It's so cool. Is this something that you thought you would do at some point, something that's so freeform after all of, you know, the songwriting that you've done in previous years?
Yeah, actually, I always wanted to do it. You know, bands have rules, right? You know, the Rolling Stones have rules. U2 has rules, you know. And, you know, for example, I don't think either of them ever played a polka. So Rolling Stones and U2 have a rule, no polkas. And when I started the Blasters with my brother, there was a lot of rules, you know, and chosen wisely, you know. But sort of what the Third Mind way of playing was against a lot of Blaster rules, not all, but a lot. And the same when I was in X, there was definitely, you know, well, actually I should take that back, because when I joined X, it was sort of became a louder version of our little side project, The Knitters.
Right. So The Knitters came first and then X.
And then I joined X. And in The Knitters, we could get pretty goofy and outside at times, especially me and DJ Bonebreak, the drummer. And so when I joined X, you know, there were songs of theirs that just changed, because their guitar player had been this guy, Billy Zoom, who created all these very intricate, you know, mechanical, you know, tightly woven, almost like the, you know, the gears on a motor, guitar parts, you know, where I was always a little more messy, you know. And so we would do things like, they had a song called Johnny Hit Run Pauline, and every, you know, and I'd seen X since like 1978, you know, and every time they played Johnny Hit Run Pauline, it was exactly the same. The differences were in John and X's vocals, delivery, their phrasing, things like that, but musically, always the same. So when I joined X, suddenly Johnny Hit Run Pauline became like 8 minutes of Johnny, you know, 3 minutes of Johnny Hit Run Pauline, and then 5 minutes of me and DJ basically summoning up Albert Eiler or Eric Dolphy, you know, or trying to. And, you know, just goofing off. And in my own bands throughout my solo career, there's always been sections of the set where, you know, there's like two or three songs where we never have an ending. We don't know, but there's not a fixed, you know, okay, play this chord, and then we're done. You know, it's none of that. And that's great, you know, and it keeps the musicians on their toes, and it keeps them involved in the sound of the band. And they're not just being, you know, I really don't like people that are just, that approach it as, I'm backing up, you know, so-and-so, keep time on drums, you know, which right. is what virtuosos, great guitar players or harmonica players or sax players, all they want is somebody that's keeping time because I'm the star. Where my attitude has always been, you know, cover up my mistakes, you know, make yeah, I'm serious.
But also give you something to react to. I mean, you guys are, part of what's cool about it is that you are all these musicians who are totally, you can feel the sort of intuitive way you're reading each other and playing off each other.
The thing about the third mind became finding the right musicians that could do it, you know, because a lot of musicians don't like playing that way. And I understand that, because if I get called to a recording session, you know, first thing I want to know, oh, okay, well, you know, what's the song? What's the key? When, you know, do I do a solo or am I just playing? You know, you got all these kind of nuts and bolts questions. Is it a loud song? Is it a quiet song? Or are we following the singer? Are we following the drummer? Who are we following? But with the third mind, the idea was, you know, we won't know till we do it. And so because most musicians don't want to play that way, you have to find people that do. And I knew Victor, because I had sat in with Victor a couple times, like in the 80s, when he would go sit in with Eugene Chadbourne.
Right.
And I think it was Madison, Wisconsin, or Bloomington, Indiana, maybe somewhere in the Midwest. I sat in, and we had a great time. And, you know, and this is back in the days when I was full-on pompadour guy, and everybody, you know, just expected, you know, certain kind of guitar playing from me. And it was like, no, we just have rules in the blasters that we don't play that way. And when I'm not, I can do whatever I want. You know, I'd already done, you know, like a record with this group called the Flesh Eaters, which was pretty outside. It was punk rock ish, but it was also like freeform jazz at the same time. So, you know, that was all kind of fun. And so I knew Victor was into it. So we talked for years about, you know, doing something like this, you know, doing recording basically kind of like Miles Davis did, particularly the electric period of Miles Davis around Bitches Brew and all that, where some of that stuff was done on total improvisation. And then Miles and his producer, Teo Macero, would then take razor blades and cut the tapes. And make them into compositions. I always suffered from, I guess you could call it, jazz envy. You know, as a songwriter, songwriting's hard. Songwriting takes me a lot of time. I was kind of jealous of, oh, these guys just go in and blow.
Right. They're just playing. off each other.
And it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether it's more traditional stuff, like, you know, yeah, it's Coleman Hawkins with Teddy Wilson, you know, or whether it's, you know, Lenny Tristano with Charlie Parker. You know, it doesn't, you know, they just get the blow. And so, it's, yeah, it's kind of a little bit of jazz envy. But then it was, again, it was finding the right guys and gals to do this. Victor, you know, I was familiar with David Immergluck. I'd heard him with Camper, and I'd heard him with John Hiatt and those sort of things. And I'd met him. When Victor said, what about Michael Jerome? And I was like, oh, he won't do it, man. You know. And I had, in around 1999, year 2000, somewhere around there, I did a tour with opening for Richard Thompson. And Michael had just joined the Richard Thompson band, and he was like 20 years old, and they're 21, he's just a kid. And most of the shows, and this is no offense to the brilliant Richard Thompson, I wasn't watching Richard, I was watching Michael. And I was going like, I don't know what, and I don't know when, and I don't know where, but someday we're going to do something together musically. Throughout my career, I've been fortunate to only play with great drummers. But musicians are just different, you know? Everybody plays differently. Everybody psychologically approaches it differently, you know? And when you find people that, you know, I use the example of, you know, if you've got a blues band, and you have a bass player that hates the blues, you're going to have a shitty blues band. All it takes is one person who's like, oh, this is so boring, three chords. I want to play Yes, you know. Same in country music or punk rock or whatever. And you can take that same bass player that's bored in your blues band, and then you start a, I don't know, an English folk band, and which is what they want to play, and you'll have this wonderful magic happening. So when Victor then called Michael, and Michael said, oh, hell yes. And then I was just like, well, we're dialed, you know, we'll have nothing to worry about, you know, because Emmy and I and Victor, we could just screw up and play, each one of us playing in a different key, and as long as Michael's playing drums, we'll sound good, you know. And then Victor wanted to do, when we were discussing, you know, we knew that we didn't have the money to fully record like Miles recorded, meaning hours and hours of jamming and improvisation and then editing. We had a limited amount of money on the first album, well, on all the albums. So it was like, we need forms, you know, for us to then extrapolate off of those forms. And then, you know, we discussed kind of like, well, I think that we should keep it in the early to late 60s, you know, 1970, maybe 71 at the most. Songs that kind of come out of the folk and blues tradition, and then take that as our launching point. And so one of the songs Victor wanted to do was Morning Dew. And I kind of felt like, you know, man, everybody's done that. And we'd really have, you know, what are we going to do it like a polka? You know, how are we going to do it that's different? And then it dawned on me, I just thought, wow, well, you know, and then Victor wanted me to sing it. And I was like, no, I'm not the person to sing Morning Dew. And then I just thought, well, you know, I know who the person is. And not only is she a unique singer and a sweetheart of a person, but she also, that sort of period of time, and her name was Jesse Sykes, and that period of time that we're sort of pulling our material from is a period of time that's where she was influenced musically. That's where her,
right.
And she loves 5-minute guitar solos. She loves the whole jamming thing, you know. And so I called her up, and she had sort of semi-retired, and I knew her for years up in Seattle, and she was living out in Iowa, in Ames, Iowa. And I called her up and said, "You want to come out and sing Morning Dew? We're kind of doing this weird thing." And she said, "Yeah." And then once I heard her sing with us, it was like, that's the voice, you know, because I don't want to sing on Third Mind Records, because if I sing on it, then it becomes a Dave Alvin record. And, you know, I wanted a voice that was like different, you know.
Right. Third voice.
Yeah.
You sung on records, Victor sung on records, but this is something different.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it gives the band, you know, the band has this personality or, you know, or sound, where it's not like, I gotta say this carefully. You wanted to sound unique. You wanted to put it on and go, okay, well, you have this sort of two different guitar players approaching the same song differently. You know, my background is in blues and R&B and you know, garage rock, and that's how I go for it. You know, it's like, if you give me a song, I immediately think, well, how would Magic Sam play this? You know, and where David Immergluck is a totally different type of guitar player. Both approaches are valid, but they're just different. And but then part of the sound of the band is contrasting guitar styles. But with Jesse singing, then it's like, it's really different. It's different than your average instrumental band with vocals. Right. A lot of sort of open-ended freeform bands, you know, they tend to try to sing like Jerry Garcia or something, or Phil, or Bob Weir, or you know, whomever, and that's great, you know. But this has to be its own thing. This is not just this is not, you know, Tuesday night at the local bar tribute band. You know, this is, we're trying to do something. You know, we're paying tribute to the people that wrote the songs, and to various people that played this way, you know, whether it was Michael Bloomfield or John Cipollina or Jerry Garcia or whomever. But at the same time, we wanted to be the Third Mind. We wanted it to be different. So, and Jesse's voice just struck me as, well, that's different, you know.
She's kind of the Sandy Denny of the group, in a way, right. You know. It's, I mean, not like you guys sound like a British folk rock band, but there are these times where it's, you know, Fairport would stretch out, and you know, it's, you know, there's a reason she was, you know, on Led Zeppelin records too. So it all makes sense. And how much is your playing, you know, influenced by what David Immergluck is playing? Like, are you guys kind of looking to each other to adapt your styles, or is it really just like, we're just going to do what we do and figure out how it works together?
It's both, you know. At some point, it's both, where it's like on the live album, the Live Mind, the guitar player is Mark Caron, who's an amazing guitar player. And David Immergluck can't really do shows. I don't think he likes to play live, where everybody else in the band loves to play live. Victor suggested Mark. And I was familiar. I'd seen Rat Dog when Mark was in the band, and so I kind of made a note of, well, that guy's pretty good, you know. And so I was like, yeah, that'd be great. And so with David, it's, I'm listening sort of for one kind of thing, and playing with Mark, I'm listening for a different kind of thing to play off of. And with David Immergluck, it's, you know, David's, you know, he can play straight as anybody. And he can play, you know, what you kind of predict maybe someone would play. But then he can also play just from so far in left field, you know, that if you're playing baseball, he's so far in left field, he's over in the football stadium next door. And you kind of have to go, okay, all right. And how do I support him? How do I support his solos? How is he going to be supporting me when I take my solo? How are we going to interact when Jesse's singing? What are we doing, you know? And when do I got to stay out of the way? And when do I take over? And but a lot of that, the great thing about both David and Mark Heron is it's unspoken, you know? It's maybe, I think maybe once or twice I'll say, I'll tell you what, you do the fills and the verse, and then I'll take the solo right after. And that's maybe happened once or twice. And right. It's really, you know, the intense thing about playing both in the studio and playing live is, you know, is you have to be listening. You can't just, sometimes when you're recording, let's say you're just recording a song, you've got a new song and you're working on your record. And my records are all recorded live as well, live in the studio, and then everybody's in the same room, and it, you know, same thing as if they're mine, but we're only going for, you know, 3.5, 4 minutes, maybe 5. And so you've got your little cues of where you're going to do this, where you're going to do that. Oh, we can stretch out here, this, that, and the other. And so you're paying attention to that. And with me, it's like I'm paying attention to, well, is the groove fitting the lyrics? Is it, you know, are the lyrics any good? Is the song any good? But with the Third Mind, because we know the songs are good, because they tend to be, you know, covers, then, you know, you have to listen to what Michael's playing, to listen to what Victor's playing, and then you really have to listen to Jesse, because especially on the second album, she kicks everything off, and then we can extrapolate from there. But she's, you know, where is Jesse comfortable? How is she singing this? And then how are we going to approach it from based off what she's doing? And, you know, but to get back to your question, yeah, with David, it's I'll lean maybe to playing more this way because he's playing that way, you know, like, right. Oh, okay, you're going to play real outside. I'm going to play real inside. And the same thing with Mark, you know, except it's a little different because Mark's a different guitar player than David. Mark's a little more, he plays a little bit more like me, and that Mark can definitely do blues and R&B and that kind of stuff. But Mark can also do, because of his 13 years with Bob Weir and his 2 years with Phil Lesh and all that, he can do all the sort of San Francisco Garcia stuff. And we can also cue off each other at the same time off of, you know, some obscure King Curtis record from 1960, you know, and play that kind of groove. So with Mark, maybe if Mark's playing a little more this way, I'll go a little more that way. I'll go a little more outside with Mark.
Right. And,
so, yeah. It's just fun.
I sing to you across tall grass.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. No matter the weather, Cold Time hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Well, and you're not like rehearsing this stuff, right? I mean, you're not sort of like, okay, let's get this one solid arrangement and this is what we're going to play, right? I mean, it's not like you don't know the songs, but...
Well, in the studio, the rehearsal is the album.
Right. Like you go, in other words, when you go into the studio and start recording, you've not played these songs before together.
No, there's a couple of songs. There's a song on the second album that Jesse and I wrote called Tall Grass. And so the rehearsal on that was Jesse and I over the phone, me in California and her in Seattle or Iowa or wherever. And, you know, that was our rehearsal. Then we took it into the band and said, okay, what do you guys think? How are you going to approach this? And, you know, we've been doing recording lately for another studio album. And we have the same thing. We have a song that she and I wrote together. And the band never heard it until we rehearsed. I mean, until we recorded. So the rehearsal was just Jesse and I on the phone. You know, hey, well, let's do a C major seventh here or whatever. Yeah, the idea is go into the recording studio. Well, before we did the live gigs, because we'd never played live before, and our first live gig was at the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival, and we did do a rehearsal because we wanted to work, you know, Mark into sort of the, this is how this band works, and, you know, I'll cue you when it's, the song's over, you know. So there are sections, particularly when, you know, when Jesse's singing, you know, that we have to keep things kind of controlled. But then once she's done singing, then we can go wherever we want. And so what was amazing at the first gig was, okay, we knew we were going to play Morning Dew and East West, but we sort of played them different, you know, than we did at rehearsal. And then when we went up and we did a run of shows from the Pacific Northwest down all the way down to San Diego, and every night was different. It was just stunning, you know. I mean, Michael, Jerome, he doesn't use a metronome. He's not one of those, you know, sort of pop rock drummers that has click track earphones.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
He doesn't need it. And what's amazing is when I was going through putting together the tracks for the Live Mind record, the engineer, Craig Parker Adams, and I, you know, we started calling him Mr. Metronome, because it didn't matter whether you were in San Francisco or San Diego or, you know, Dallas or L.A., they were always the same. He was playing different things. Like one night he would be playing more where you have one hand with the drumstick, you know, keeping time on a ride cymbal or a hi-hat, but then his hands would be, you know, working the various percussion pieces that he has set up around his drum kit. And then the next night it'd be totally different, but it would be in the right time. And so, you know, it was just awe-inspiring, you know, and sort of like you were talking about him kicking, you know, Richard Thompson to play into another level. It was the same that he does that to everybody in this band. It's like, well, I can't slough this one off, you know. I got to play good. I got to go home and practice, you know. I got to play with Michael.
I mean, the first album was, what, 2020? And then a whole lot of crap happened between then and the second album. I mean, there's pandemic. Yeah. You were fighting cancer. Yeah. And but then you brought everyone, you know, back together and did this. Like, how much of a change was it when you know, got the band back together and said, all right, we did the first part, but we didn't get to tour then for all these reasons. Like, was there a different sort of resolve when you reformed it now?
For me, there was, because I had, when I was, you know, I was in the hospital a lot, when I was dealing with the cancer jazz, and, you know, I would, you know, you lay there and you got, you know, nothing to do, right? Except just ponder the future if you're going to have one. And, so that was one of my goals, was, okay, no matter what, we're making another Third Mind record, you know, and I had other things, you know. I want to do another record, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and I want to do a Dave Alvin solo album, blah, blah, blah. But God damn it.
But this was at the top of your list.
Yeah, it was. It was just, well, I felt like we got denied because by COVID and then my cancer, you know, which happened to, you know, exactly the same time. And so Yeah, we had a tour, you know, booked, you know, doing the East Coast and the Midwest and all that, and just denied. And in a weird way, it might have been for the best, because the band has been allowed to kind of, you know, find our sound before we go out and really do heavy touring. You know, usually it's throw a band out there and, you know, burn them out before their second album. And this is like, well, this band's had a lot of time to gestate. And okay, what do you got? We all still in the same headspace, and we all still want to do, you know, this and this. And like I said, we've been recording a new studio thing, and it's even, you know, the band's sort of interplay and the band's concept of itself is really getting set, you know. It's, you know, it's liberating.
So third album already coming up, Third Mind. And is it again one where you have covers and then some, you know, some originals with you and Jesse writing them?
Yeah. I'm not supposed to be saying any of this. So,
all right. Well, we'll all pretend that we didn't hear it, but that's cool. Are you going to tour and, you know, come farther east, like Chicago?
Yeah. The point, you know, it's so difficult, with everybody's troubles, you know, that getting the Third Mind together, you know, we only really record for 3-4 days at the most. And that's not because we're bitching, you know. It's not like,
I mean, it helps that you're bitching, but it's not because you're bitching.
You know, it's just, well, when is everybody available? Oh, Tuesday. Okay, great. Tuesday through Saturday. Great. That's when we'll go make a record. And, so touring, yeah, you know, it's been problematic. We had a tour lined up for after the second album that was more extensive. But Jesse got offered, there's this band, I think they're a band, called Sunno, SUNN00, close parentheses, quote. And it's these two guys that basically play the loudest music I've ever heard.
Wow. And that's saying something given the scene you came out of.
Oh yeah, no, this everything I came out of now with these compared to these guys was folk night at the local coffee shop. Loudest thing I ever heard. And I went and saw their show in LA, and apparently these guys are incredibly popular with this, and it's not even songs, it's pieces. And it's kind of similar to Third Mind, I think, because, you know, except there's, on most of the things, there's no singing or anything. It's just, they hit tones. It's two guys with Les Pauls playing through, you know, like each playing through about 5 Marshall stacks. And it's just.
And then she's singing over that.
Oh, no, she was the opening act.
Oh, okay. I thought she was like in the band or something singing over that, and I'm like, whoa.
The tour of Europe, and Europe was where Jesse really had the most success in her solo career.
Got it.
Thereafter. And you know, like I said, she had kind of retired and she was getting back into playing music again. And, you know, so I was mad at first, but I understood, you know. One, they're paying her, which, you know, Third Mind, we don't make any money. You know, it's the Third Mind, it's a true labor of love. And so they were paying her to do these dates. And one, she's, you know, she can go over and back to Paris and London and all that, where she was her most popular. And reestablish herself as, yes, I'm back. I'm still alive. I'm, you know. So, because they offered her that gig, we had to cancel basically our tour. But, you know, showbiz.
That's a drag. Yeah. Also, would be established as the singer of this new hot band of pros. And so how big was the tour? And are you going to try to, you know, get it going again? Because you did that with that sort of West Coast swing.
Yeah. The West Coast is kind of easy for us because everybody, with exception, well, when Jessie's in Seattle, she's West Coast. Everybody's West Coast. It's just easy. And because, you know, the money, you know, the one thing I'm good at after all of my years in the music racket is knowing how much you need to survive, you know, and how low of an overhead to keep. And so with the Third Mind, it's like I said, everybody, Michael and everybody, it's like, well, if we make any money, great, but we're not doing this for money, you know? And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in the Midwest and the East Coast and you know, financially, you know, but we'll make it work.
I feel like once word of mouth spread about what you guys were doing and what your live shows were like, I would think, you know, that would build. But what do I know? I'm being self-centered because I just want to get you guys to come this way. I'll probably just come west to see you anyway. But it would be great to get you the rest of the country.
You know, I've always, from going back to my days when, you know, when we started the Blasters and people were telling us, oh, you'll never get anywhere playing that kind of music. Nobody wants to hear that junk, you know. And my feeling was that, no, but I do. You know? So we're going to play it and then see what happens. It's the same thing with the Third Mind. It's like, you know, at first, particularly with the first album, when that came out, there were a lot of puppy dog heads, you know, a lot of, what doesn't sound like, you know, that's not Dave Allen, you know. And but I think now with time, people are kind of getting used to, well, you know, I'm still that other guy. I'm still me. And then I can go, but I'm also this guy.
You're that other guy, but sometimes you go to outer space.
Yeah, well, for example, on the live album, there's a sort of a truncated version of Dark Star.
Right.
And that kind of happened on that tour accidentally. It just, we were at the end of the Fred Neil song, A Little Bit of Rain, we vamp out on the four chord and see where, we were just, you know, let's see where it takes us. And so at one of the gigs, it took us to Dark Star. Just kind of out of the blue. It's like, wow, okay. And then, and we weren't trying to do sort of a, you know, there's so many of those great musicians have those dead tribute bands, and they can sound like, you know, they'll pick a show and they'll pick a year, and, you know, we're doing 1972 Stockholm, you know, or whatever, and they'll play it note for note, and this ain't that kind of deal. This is a little bit maybe, you know. Anyway,
were you a Dead fan?
Yes and no. I wasn't a Deadhead, but I really liked kind of opposing sides of the Dead. I liked the Working Man Dead, American Beauty era. But what I really liked was when they were playing outside, when they were playing in outer space. Because the beautiful thing about the Grateful Dead, and yeah, I admired them, you know, on a punk rock level, because they managed to exist outside of the music industry, right? They managed to, you know, they spent seven, eight, 9 years between studio albums, between record deals, and still managed to become this massively profitable live act, you know, sort of like, you know, in the way that back in the glory days of country music, you know, Ernest Tubb could go decades without a hit record, but there'd always be a crowd at an Ernest Tubb show. And that was always sort of the Blasters thing, was we can go out and, because we're a great live show, people will come see us whether we have a record or not. And I've been fortunate, there's a little bit of that in my career, where I can continually tour and, you know, screw up and discover new things and this and the other, and yet people still come to the shows. And so anyway, back to the Dead, you know, so I admired that aspect of the Dead, of they could create their own music industry. And where, say, Quicksilver or Electric Flag or whoever couldn't, the Dead, whether they were smart or whether it just happened, they managed to exist outside of the record industry. And anyway, so what I really liked was when they were playing outside, when they played outside, it was, you know, it wasn't jazz, right? But it wasn't pop rock. And there was nobody that could do that the way that they did it, you know, when they were really on. And yeah, did it approach jazz? Yeah, but it ain't jazz. It's rock and roll improvisation. And so, yeah, people always think that, oh, well, if you like the Dead, Dave, you probably like Working Man's Dead. Yeah, I like that. That's good. But what I really like, you know, is when they did the 20-minute version of Dark Star and, you know, some bootleg that somebody gave me. Because, you know, nobody else played like that, you know, or could, you know, or knew how, you know. I had a quick conversation with Don Was, because one of my dearest friends in the world is a genius guitar player, pedal steel player, lap steel player named Greg Lease. And Greg had been doing these Bob Weir broadcasts during COVID, and where Don Was had and Bob Weir had put together this band. And so we were talking about, you know, Greg and all that. And Greg had had his comments about playing with Bob, how interesting it was, and this and the other. But what Don Was said was, you know, we both kind of were like, yeah, when they were playing outside, playing all different parts and this, that, and the other, and seemingly unrelated to each other, and yet fitting perfectly together. Don Was says, yeah, I never could figure out how to play like that, so I figured I go right to the source. You know, and he said, that's why I wanted to play with Bob Weir.
There you go.
Makes total sense, you know. And, you know, so that's what I liked about the Dead. But also, you know, I was always kind of a bit more of a Quicksilver guy, you know. The first two Quicksilver albums. And anytime I heard John Cipollina, my ears always, hello, you know. When I was a little kid, and these days, you know, there's a lot of bad stuff that he's on, and I'll listen to it just for that moment of pure Cipollina-ness. I'm just like, wow, what was he, you know, because he's another guy that I like, people that play what you're not going to expect them to play, you know, and yet sound like them, you know. And John Cipollina is a perfect example, because, you know, he didn't play like Jerry Garcia. He didn't play like, you know, Jeff Beck or Michael Bloomfield or whomever. He just played like John Cipollina, and that was a beautiful thing.
Were like John Cipollina, Mike Bloomfield, were these the people who were sort of in your head when you started playing guitar? Did you think, oh, I want to do something in that direction?
Yes and no. Yeah, you know, I mean, I grew up influenced by a lot of music. I mean, I love all musics. Well, with the exception of a few, but, you know, and as a musician, you soak it all in. And as a kid, when you don't know, you really don't know what genre means. You just know, I like this, I don't like that. I like this, I don't know why I like this, but I like it.
And you started off playing sax and flute, right? So you sort of came at it from a little bit of an odd angle, because you were hearing horn parts before you were playing guitar parts.
Yeah. Well, there were guitar players. The story on that is, in where I grew up in Downey, California, there were in sort of the surrounding area, Pico Rivera, Bellflower, Santa Fe Springs, Southgate. For whatever reason, at that time, there were these older guys, you know, like 4 or 5 years older than me. There was just this plethora of brilliant guitar players who all played differently, you know. There were guys that, there was a guy, one of the best guitar players I ever heard in my entire life was a guy from Downey named Mike Roach. And Mike had everything going for him. He had a 58 gold top Les Paul. He was good looking. He looked like a total teenage heartthrob kind of look. And yet he could play Bach on acoustic guitar, and then he had an electric guitar, and he would play blues, but he would play blues that was just totally unexpected, you know. I recently got some tapes of him jamming with my brother's teenage blues band in a factory, and the lines that he's playing are just so abstract. Huh. And yet, anyway, there were guys like that. And so if you were going to get invited to hang out at the jam sessions, and I was the little brother, right? I'd never get invited as a guitar player, you know? So I was like, how can I get invited? Oh yeah. Well, you know, I always liked saxophone, and I liked the flute. I liked Charles Lloyd, and I liked Yusef Lateef, and like, okay, I'll be Yusef Lateef, you know? And, but I was always staring at guitar players, you know. I was always doing that. How's he doing that? What's he doing over here? You know, and my cousin Mike, older cousin Mike Keller, who's about, about 8 years older than me and my brother. Mike had been a folkie, and that's where we, early on in our life, we discovered, you know, like Dave Anrock and Ramblin' Jack Elliott, you know. And he turned us on to the Butterfield band, to the first Butterfield band record, things like that. But he played guitar and he played banjo. So at family gatherings, and he'd play, and I'd, you know, just an 8-year-old kid, just sitting there, how's he doing? Where's his fingers going? You know, doing that. And so it wasn't until much later in life, really with the advent of punk rock, where I decided, yeah, I can be a guitar player too. I was always messing around on guitar, but it was finally punk rock gave me the permission, you know. It's like, okay, not only am I going to be a guitar player, I'll be a loud guitar player.
You know? Did you have guitars sitting around the house, or you have your own guitar?
Oh yeah.
You guys had a musical household.
Yeah. I mean, we, on one hand, my brother Phil and I, you know, we collected records, you know, and, you know, starting at childhood, you know, like toddler, you know, we had this older cousin, Donna, who would give us her old records when she would play them to the point where they were scratched, you know. And she gave us things like, you know, Big Joe Turner and Ray Charles and Laverne Baker and a whole lot of West Coast doo-wop records, you know, the Medallions and the, the Penguins, things like that. And then, my cousin Mike had the folk side of things covered. And then my cousin JJ he grew up on a ranch up in the, what's now all tract homes, but back then was ranch land. And his thing was country music. And so just soaked all that in, you know, from blues to R&B to country to rock and roll to folk music. So Bloomfield and Cipollina and Jimi Hendrix, you know, I was fortunate. I got to see Jimi Hendrix twice when I was like 12, 13 years old.
Wow.
My mom drove me.
Nice.
And she waited out in the car with the strict instructions, you know, do not eat or drink anything inside there. You know, I know what they do in there. So when you see Jimi Hendrix at that young age, you're always going to, you know, that became a huge influence, not so much in the way I play, because it's not really until really the third mind that maybe you pull out some Hendrix tricks, you know, because I just consider Jimi Hendrix unapproachable, you know, like, don't try to play like him, you know, because then you'll just sound silly. You know, because only Jimi Hendrix could do that. Only he could look that way and play that way, because the way he played was so much attached to the way he looked and sang and thought, you know, that it's the lesson I learned from, you know, at the same time that I was seeing Jimi Hendrix, about a year later, my brother Phil and I started going to shows sneaking into clubs to see, you know, Lightnin' Hopkins and, you know, people like that, Sonny Terry, Brownie McGhee, you know, Reverend Gary Davis, Johnny Guitar Watson, you know. And the lessons, you know, we got to be friends with some of the older blues performers. And, you know, for a lot of white guys, there's a tendency to, you know, then want to, they get influenced by that. And then they want to, you know, I'm going to sing like Lightnin' Hopkins, you know, and I'm going to be Lightnin' Hopkins. And I learned early on that it's not, you know, because you can't be like Lightnin' Hopkins. You can't be like, you know, Jimi Hendrix. You can't be them. You can be from them. You know, you can take things from them. You know, so yeah. So whether it was Bloomfield or John Cipollina, that was always around, and that was always in my guitar playing DNA.
When you saw it, when you saw Jimi Hendrix, you saw him twice. Like, how close together was it, and what bands was he playing with?
The first time I saw him was at this music festival called the Devonshire Downs, Monterey Pop Devonshire Downs. And it was a 3-day festival, and I went on the Sunday, I believe it was. No, it was a Saturday. I was up Saturday, and he was supposed to play on an aborted short set, and it was aborted for whatever reason, police or whatever. And so then he came back and did this unannounced show, or they just kind of said, "Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Jimi Hendrix." And it was like,
whoa.
It wasn't where he had played with the Experience the night or two before. This was Jimi Hendrix with Buddy Miles on drums. And I'm pretty sure it's Harvey Brooks on bass from, you know, because the Electric Flag had played the festival. And so it was basically, and then some horns. So I imagine they were, you know, the Electric Flag horns. And he just went up and started playing, and then they played for about, I don't know, 45 minutes, 50 minutes, and basically a lot of blues, but it was blues from Mars, you know? It might have been, you know, the birth of the band of Gypsies in some ways, but it was all free form. And, you know, with Jimi Hendrix. And then the second time I saw him was at the was about 3 months later at the Fabulous Forum over in Inglewood, and that was with Mitch Mitchell on drums and Billy Cox on bass. And it was similar in that he was playing real outside, and I believe that show's just been released by the people that release Hendrix records. I've had a copy of that show for like 20 years, and because a friend of mine was working with Steve Douglas, who in those days handled the Hendrix stuff. And I was explaining about this forum show and what Hendrix said and what he played and this and the other. And this guy just says, and I was like, I don't know. I was 13 years old. I don't know if I'm remembering it right, but he did this and he did that. And then he said this and there was a riot and the cops were there and blah, blah, blah. And the guy just turned around, swiveled around in his chair. We were in his recording studio working on something. He just swiveled around. Oh, here. And he handed me, I was like, yes. And I took it home and listened, and it was exactly like I remembered.
Wow.
And the thing about Hendrix, and the thing about a lot of the musicians that I didn't realize it at the time, but the thing about Hendrix was you never knew what he was going to do, right? You didn't know what he was going to do. If you went to a Jimi Hendrix show thinking, okay, I'm going to hear Stone Free and Purple Haze and this, that, and the other, and he's going to play his hits and we'll all bob our heads. No. You know, you're going to get, you know, in the true sense of a folk and blues performer, you're going to get him at that moment being where he is at that moment, you know. And that could be, maybe he's going to phone in the set, you know, I don't care. But no, odds are you're going to get something that the people the night before did not get. You know, you'll get Purple Haze, but you'll get it in a way that you didn't get the night before, you know. And to me, I mean, Victor and I, this is one of our discussions regarding Third Mind, was just how choreographed modern music has become, you know, that includes everything from, you know, pop music, which is choreographed in the true sense of the word. It's right. all about, you know, angular dance movements now. And, And, you know, even in hip hop, it's about, you know, it's choreographed to a sense. And even in roots rock, and, you know, sort of in my realm, it's a lot of choreographed stuff going on. And meaning, I know what's going to happen. Like, I went to see this guy, who remained nameless, he's a pretty big star, because his people called me, his person called me, and invited me to the show that the guy was doing here in L.A. And I was like, well, okay, you know, it's nice of him to call. And so I went to the show, and I was bored shitless, you know, because where the songs are fine and all that, that's all great. And as a performer, this guy's fine. But it was all, I knew exactly what was going to happen. He had a couple of really good guitar players in his band, and they would walk out. This wasn't a club. This was like a 3,000-seat place, you know. And these guys would walk out to a specific place in the stage where the spotlight then would hit them, and they would play their 16-bar solo or their 12-bar solo or whatever, and then they'd walk back into the shadows. And I just thought, well, I'm sure they're getting a nice paycheck, but God, that would drive me nuts, you know. Every night I'm here we go. And there you go, good night, you know, and playing probably the same guitar licks and everything. And I just thought, you know, this is the total, you know, that kind of thing is great if you're the Count Basie Orchestra, you know. And I saw the Basie Orchestra when I was a teenager, you know, and it was awe-inspiring. It's great if you're James Brown and the JBs, you know, to have that sort of approach, because James Brown, you don't know what the hell James Brown's going to do, right? Right. You've got to be tight so that James can then extrapolate. But when you're not James Brown and you're not Count Basie or something like Duke Ellington or something like that, it's Dullesville, you know? For me, it, the thing about punk rock, when you would go to see punk rock shows, you didn't know what was going to happen. You didn't know, you know, maybe the, you know, it may be because the bass player just scored and is going to play all fucked up, you know, but it's still something you've never heard before. It's going to happen. And, you know, and it's like going to see great jazz performers or great, you know, if you see a really great, you know, of the older blues performers, you really didn't know what they were going to do. You know, if you saw Lightnin' Hopkins, you knew you were going to see Lightnin' Hopkins, but you didn't know what Lightnin' Hopkins was going to do. You know, anything could have happened. Same with, like, you know, like my friend Ramblin' Jack Elliott. You go see Ramblin' Jack, you don't have a clue what Jack's going to do. And so it's just extrapolating that kind of thing into, you know, into my own music, and then into the third mind of, you know, I think that there's a hunger. Maybe not in society as a whole, but I think that there's a large enough amount of people that are fed up with that, or bored of that, you know? You know, and we have to encourage freedom, you know?
Yeah, there's something to be said for spontaneity in almost everything at this point, because so much in our culture is programmed at this point. And it's not to say that you don't watch the Grammys and are not impressed by the young talent coming up, but it is a very choreographed experience and not like the, you know,
yeah, it's
coming out and doing their thing.
It's a Broadway show. Most pop music is a Broadway show now. I had a friend who played with a very successful singer, and he made a lot of money, a pop singer. But after like 3 years, you know, he bought a house and then, you know, basically attained upper middle class status playing with this pop singer. But he was bored shitless. And he said, and he's the one that gave me that concept of, you know, the band was all amazing musicians. And, but he said, you know, the only time that he could improvise, and he's a master, you know, improviser, was at the end of the night when they would do the introduce the band thing. And on drums, so-and-so, and on guitar, so-and-so, do it, you know. So that was it. So the rest was, it was a Broadway show. You know, the singer was choreographed to stand certain places and deliver things a certain way, and the band had to just play the same parts every night like you're in a Broadway pit orchestra. And, you know, so much music now, pop music, is electronic or electronic driven, meaning, you know, the drums, there's not a drummer that's leading the band, there's not a guitar player, you know, nobody's leading the band except the recording engineer who's going, okay, you know. And so the singers and the whatever dancers are then choreographed around these grooves and these beats. And then the other thing that really pisses me off, I'll sound like an old man here, but
that's all right.
I would say the same thing when I was 17. So nothing's really changed. What gets me now is the how lip syncing is accepted. It's just accepted. It's oh, that's okay. You know, because when you have these singers that, you know, may or may not be great singers, you know, you can't tell with auto-tune and all that, but they're doing these movements, you know, and at the same time, they're holding long notes. So they'll be like, oh, you know, hold that long note and then do these, you know, semi-aerobic class / topless bar dancing. Hold long notes or sing on pitch. It's just, you can't do it. So they're lip syncing, right? And it's just become the norm now of, you know, it doesn't matter who you are. You know, it's like if you watch Saturday Night Live, I'm just stunned. Every act is lip syncing now, you know. A couple of years back, Jack White was filled in like a last minute thing on Saturday Night Live. And it was amazing because he actually had a little band and they played, you know. I was like, well, hell, you know, there's one guy that understands what rock and roll is. And you know, rock and roll, you know, is you know, it may be an endangered thing now, or it may be dead. I mean, who knows? But that was always, to me, what was great about rock and roll, whether it was a Sun record in the 1950s or a country blues record in the 1930s or Bob Dylan, Blonde on Blonde, is... it was a little out of control. There was freedom. And you were shooting for that. And there was an openness, you know? And now everything's just like, keep it here, keep it tight.
That's it for episode 168 of Caropop. Thanks so much to Dave Alvin for going deep with us into his musical values and history. The albums The Third Mind and The Third Mind 2 are available from Yep Rock Records, and Live Mind is out on the label February 14th. Look up The Third Mind on YouTube and check out the videos, and you'll want to keep going down that rabbit hole. Go to davealvin.net for more information about him, The Third Mind, his solo works, upcoming tour dates, and his 2022 book, New Highway, selected lyrics, poems, prose, essays, eulogies, and blues. The Third Mind has live dates March 19th and 21st in Morro Bay and San Juan Capistrano, California, respectively. Dave Alvin is on Instagram and Facebook at Dave Alvin Original. Caropop is produced by Chris Swake, who spent a lot of time listening to the Border Radio. If you'd like to throw something into the Caropop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at caropop.com. Thanks so much for listening and being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Caropop on the so-called socials at CaroPopCast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for part 2 of our Caropop conversation with Dave Alvin. Thanks.